Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
There's two kinds of reliefs that are taking place right now. One of them is a bailout for corporate America, and then there is a band-aid relief towards the people. You know, millions of people are yet to receive one penny from the government. Millions. That's a failure. That's troublesome. That's hurtful. That has consequences.
That's a street-level view of the lack of impact, in fact, the lack of even contact, with the neediest members of our citizenry who are living with the reality of COVID in a way that many of us are fortunate enough to have avoided. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host and senior advisor to the Public Banking Institute. Today, we're going to examine how our monetary system is addressing the COVID crisis at the state and street levels. When we hear how the easy facility that banks, corporations, hedge funds, and trading desks have to obtaining credit, and compare it with how difficult and unsuccessful the service to state and local governments and small businesses has been, we realize for whom the so-called Fed bazooka money machine has been aimed. Well, let's get right into it and talk with Ellen.
Well, Ellen, the crisis, the COVID crisis that we're living in is causing, of course, enormous impact economically. And in the world of the, you know, behind the curtain of finance, we see all kinds of machinations going on, many of which we've seen before relative to how the Federal Reserve is playing to their real clients, the big banks. And your article this week has come back to haunt them, hopefully, pointing out that they are getting a bailout of significant scale right before our eyes, but actually out of sight.
You made it look like it. This was a press release in March 15th by the Federal Reserve. They made it look like it was for the benefit of the small businesses and the borrowers, that so that the banks would be encouraged to make more loans during this these bad times. But in fact, so what they did was they lowered the interest rate to 0.25%, virtually free for banks at the discount window, said they could borrow up to 90 days, renewable daily. So it sounds like it, just like the repo market, you can just do it, roll them over day after day after day. They got rid of the reserve requirement, which meant you didn't have to keep back 10% of your deposits. And they liberalized or loosened up on the capital requirement, said you could spend your capital if you needed to, or lend it, you know, if you needed to. Don't worry about that. So, and there were no strings attached. You don't have to give any benefits to the borrowers, and they haven't, so far as we know. In Canada, they actually cut the interest rate on their credit cards by half, from 21% to 11%, the big banks did, because of the crisis, and that, you know, to help out the ordinary consumer borrowers. But our banks didn't do that. They only lowered the credit card rate by half a percentage point. So now we used to be the high end of 21, you know, almost 22%, and now it's the low end, but it's still 21%.
So the margin in that, so in case people aren't keeping track, is that the banks get their money for free, and they charge us 20% for it.
And many small businesses now can't get business loans like they used to. Their credit lines were cut after 2008. And instead, they've had to borrow on credit cards. So if you have to fund your business where you're, you get paid like 90 days or 120 days net, and you've got to pay for your workers and your materials all that time, they're in big trouble right now, particularly if they have no customers. So it was not really to help the businesses, as you can see. And it did help, clearly. They've made banking essentially risk-free. And the banks have been in trouble ever since September, or we knew they were in trouble in September, when the interest rates on the repo market went as high as 10% at one point. At that time, they were supposed to be around 2%. And, of course, they've gone lower since then. The problem was that, or so we heard, so I wrote in my last article, was that the hedge funds had taken over the repo market, and the hedge funds are very risky. They rehypothecate their collateral or leverage their collateral, meaning they use it several times over. So you don't really know who owns the collateral. Supposedly, the repo market is safe because you've got the security of some posted collateral. The repo market works like a pawn shop, so you take your collateral, probably a U.S. Treasury, and sell it. Supposedly, it's a sale and repurchase. So the borrower would sell the collateral overnight and buy it back the next day. And that's the deal. So, but because it's a deal that the buyer is required to sell it back the next day, it's basically a securitized loan day after day after day. But the trouble is that the real lenders can pull their money out on a day's notice. I mean, they don't have to renew it day after day after day. And that's what they did. They decided they didn't want to borrow lend it there anymore. That would be like the money market funds, and the big institutional investors park their money there, and they want to get a little interest. So they're the lenders, but they had pulled out, and so interest rates went up to 10%, and some of the biggest banks like J.P. Morgan were borrowing there instead, even though they've got lots of reserves left over from the quantitative easing. There was still over $1 trillion in bank reserves parked at the Fed, but they weren't using their reserves for that. They had already tied up their reserves with things like stock buybacks, et cetera. They weren't using them for loans. So we're back to the old problem that we've had over and over of, or the banks have had over and over, of borrowing short to lend long. I mean, you could go back to the 1930s with the It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart, where he was borrowing from his neighbors, who were his customers, to make 30-year long-term mortgages. And then when they all came for their money at once, when everybody panicked during the 30s because the banks were known to be in trouble, he didn't have the money to give back to the customers, the depositors, who thought they could get their money on demand. And that's always been the problem with banking, that they are, it's basically a fraud on the depositors, where they purport to have your money available on demand whenever you want it. And they always do seem to have it on demand, and yet they've lent it out. So where do they get the money? They have to borrow it somewhere. They used to borrow it before 2008. They typically borrowed some in the repo market, but they also borrowed from each other in the Fed funds market. But that pretty much dried up after 2008 because there were banks who were afraid of borrowing from each other, or lending to each other, because some banks had failed and nobody knew who the risky banks were. That was information that the Fed kept secret so they wouldn't cause some sort of a bank panic. So instead, the banks turned to the repo market, which had other advantages as well. And in fact, the repo market was set up in the first place to cater to the large institutional investors who weren't covered by FDIC insurance. The limit on that was at what was the equivalent of $100,000 in the 1930s. Roosevelt was sort of forced into it because, to protect the deposits of the private banks that were going bankrupt. But what the people were doing was pulling their deposits out of the private banks and putting them in the postal banks, which were very safe because they were government banks backed. But anyway, that Roosevelt got a lot of pressure to do FDIC insurance, so they passed the Banking Act that implemented that of 1933, and now the limit, of course, is $250,000. So that means the big institutional investors don't have anywhere to put their money that's secure, and that's largely why the repo market was developed. After 2008, one proposal during the Obama administration, or Obama raised it himself, was that we should nationalize the banks the next time they failed, because it's clear that there is no trustworthy source of credit except the government or having the backing of the government. And that's we, the people, and the full faith and credit of the U.S. dollar, of the U.S., is what's backing the dollar. And we're on the hook for all the liabilities and the risks, and therefore the banking system should be made to serve the people. Well, of course, the banks weren't nationalized. Instead, we got the Dodd-Frank Act, which imposed bail-ins the next time they failed, which meant that the money of the large creditors would be taken whenever the banks were in big trouble. But they tried that in Europe, and it didn't work. They did it in Cyprus, and it was a disaster for the local economy. And then they tried it in Italy, and it wreaked all sorts of havoc on the small business people who thought their money was safe in the bank, and then they lost it. There was one man that committed suicide and put a note on his chest that said it was because of his bank. He'd lost all his savings. And so the next time that the same bank got in trouble, the Italian government defied the EU and bailed them out anyway, put up government money to rescue the banks so that the people wouldn't be sacrificed for the bank. So we have never tried the bail-in scheme. Instead, the Fed just continually backstops the banks. And so in September, what they did was stepped in, and the Federal Reserve stepped in and became the lender, or the repo lender of last resort. But the problem didn't go away. It was thought that that was just due to some short-term crisis in the market, but it wasn't. The other lenders just never stepped back up. And in fact, more hedge funds, et cetera, everybody was borrowing in the repo market because the Fed was there as a guaranteed source. So in March, the Federal Reserve just used the cover of this virus to basically bail out the banks for good and all and permanently by opening up their discount window and lending for free. But at the same time, the Fed is lending to local governments, state and municipal governments, only, first of all, they have to go to the bond market first, and the bond market rates are going up. And only if they can't get loans in the bond market can they come to the Fed's municipal liquidity facility, and then they borrow at a penalty rate. So it's a stigma to go there, which means it's going to lower your state's credit rating, and it's going to cost even more than going to the regular bond market. So how can we, the states, get parity with the banks? What we need to do is form our own publicly owned banks, and that's, of course, what we've been pushing for a long, long time.
Do you think if the economy gets kind of somehow rebalanced that the Fed will go back to imposing a reserve requirements and restricting the banks' use of their core reserves?
Well, they could certainly reimpose those rules. And I imagine when we get in with our public banks, they'll be more strict with us, and they'll say it's because we're de novo banks that don't have a proven track record or something. So only banks with in good standing get to borrow at 0.25%. But even if you're not in good standing, if you're a risky bank, you can borrow at 0.75%. So it's only half a point more, which is still way better than states can get in the bond market.
But one thing that we do see that's consistent in this moment of crisis is the consistent practice of the Federal Reserve to bail out the big banks that basically own it, and to do it under cover of anything, darkness, bubbles, and now a virus. And your article there is, which is circulating in the national media now, certainly lays it out really clearly, Ellen. Thank you again for bringing this, of course, into focus for us. So let's talk with Carlos Marroquin, take a look at how this is impacting on the street level, and then our other guest, Amaya Payar, who was a Chicago councilman who's been promoting public banks in a major metropolis area, has a lot of insight to share with us as well as we march on here. So thanks, Ellen.
Okay, thank you.
And now we visit with Carlos Marroquin, someone who has been actively involved in the street-level recovery and service to the citizens of Los Angeles as they address the COVID crisis at the street level.
So, Carlos, we're grateful to have you on the board of directors of Public Banking Institute, and you bring a very unique perspective of what the experience of this COVID pandemic is for people living in a city, but also with a newly deflated economic prospect where money is scarce and all of their investments are compromised, if they have any. What is your frontline assessment of how things are going at this point?
Well, we're pretty troubled right now in the sense that I am seeing what I expected to see. That was a very light, if you will, response towards the people. There's two kinds of relief that are taking place right now. One of them is a bailout for corporate America, and then there is a band-aid relief towards the people. You know, millions of people are yet to receive one penny from the government. Millions. That's a failure. That's troublesome. That's hurtful. That has consequences. So what we are seeing on the ground right now is a desperation by a large group of the population. People have lost their jobs. People have no money to buy food. People are scared that they're going to be thrown out of their apartments. And the list goes on and on and on. People want to go back to work, but it's understandable. They're afraid, and we should be, because this pandemic can really hit anybody and cause a lot of harm to people. But when you look at the people on the ground, when you look at our seniors that have to come at midnight and stand on a food bank so they can get a few groceries, something is wrong with that picture. When we have people lining up, again, starting at midnight, and the lines go around several corners, and we see a lot of our seniors standing on those lines. We see moms, we see pops, we see, now we're starting to see middle-class people coming to those lines. Something's wrong with the picture, because there is plenty of money. There has been plenty of money to bail out Wall Street, to bail out corporate America, and I think that the priorities of this government are bad, are wrong, are twisted, are upside down. You know, the people, we need to protect the people, and that's what we're doing out there on the ground. We're doing whatever we can, as much as we can, so that people can have a little hope, and people can have food on their tables, and people could be, have access to be able to take a clean shower, you know, simple things as that. When we have a large population of homeless people living here in Los Angeles, you know, a simple shower, you know, is golden. It's great. It's appreciated. And those are the kind of stuff that we are working with different organizations to be able to assist some of the people that are suffering the most, the homeless population, and those that had already been struggling prior to the pandemic. Those are the people that I'm worried about. Those are the people that, that we are fighting for.
And where is the ray of hope in this horizon? Is there one at all? I mean, you have been on the front lines of alleviating suffering and supplies and so forth, but in the long-term picture, is there anything in the system, county government, state government, that provides some encouragement for correcting this?
Well, I don't see, in the near future, I don't see the government really taking charge and alleviating some of the problems. I don't see that happening. We have a present government, the present administration right now, are pretty much anti-poor. And we see that through the policies. I don't expect those policies to change. As a matter of fact, we are expecting further policies that will harm the poor, that will harm the working class, because now, according to them, we are so deep into debt that, you know, I don't see them, you know, creating opportunities, creating programs to alleviate some of these problems. Now, where does the ray of hope lie, if there is any? Well, there is. And the only changes that are going to happen is because people come together. And that's where our hope is. It's in people. It's in people coming together, fighting together, demanding and insisting that the needs of the people be met, and the wants of Wall Street and the wants of corporate America need to be rejected. It's the needs of the people. That's what we need to focus on. And that's going to come because that's going to actually, my hope is that that will happen because people understand the dire need for us to come together, to fight back. We are not going to do it if we divide it. We are not going to do it if we don't have a caring heart. We have to be able to care for one another. And what I am seeing, one of the things, the positive things that I'm seeing out of all this is the amount of people that are coming that want to do something to help other people. That's where our hope is. It's not in government. Our hope is in people, people caring for people.
Are there any organizations or agencies of Los Angeles government that are actively engaged in this, or have they also been kind of slow to rise?
No, I got to say that at the local level, I am content. I think that we could always say that more needs to be done, but I am content what I'm seeing because I do engage the political people and regarding this. Regarding their response and regarding to what they are doing for their districts and their communities. And I have seen some of the, you know, some great leadership coming from some of the local representatives. Very impressive, as a matter of fact, as to how they have responded. The problem I think that we have is the bigger government, is the federal government. I think that's where the problem is, because that's where we are not getting the help from.
And in your activity work with public banking, you were one of the principals helping to create the California public bank foray, a great success last year, last 2 years. How would you see a local public bank or a state public bank impacting this crisis?
Well, I think it's been proven that a public bank can sustain, you know, the people that they serve, you know, by offering many different kinds of services, especially right now, to the ones that are being ignored the most, and those are small businesses. Small businesses are suffering; many may not reopen. I see public banking doing a lot of good in communities. If we had a public banking up and running already in California, it would be great, because instead of investing and borrowing money from big banks, we would be able to immediately make the switch. But those things are being worked on as we speak. There is right now a lot of attention given to public banking by government officials in the state of California. I can tell you that, right, you know, because they understand that we need something different. They understand that California right now is going to be in a major economic crisis. My understanding is that the state of California, as of today, is $59 billion in the red. That's a lot of money. But being that it's also the fifth largest economy, it has been able to sustain and kind of keep those the costs down because of a lot of good organizations that have stepped up. But that can never replace, you know, what a public banking can do at a larger scale.
Yeah. Well, Carlos, thank you very much for sharing your insights and your experience on this very challenging time. And we really look forward to having a better day for all of us soon, but also for the kinds of changes that we see are necessary for the health of the people and our communities. Thank you once again for sharing this.
Sure, anytime.
That's Carlos Marroquin of Los Angeles. Now we visit with former Chicago City Councilman Amaya Pawar, a noted public official and scholar who has taken leadership roles in solving big city economic crises and who has been a strong proponent of creating a municipal public bank. Amaya is now helping lead the Economic Security Project.
When you started out in public service and in public administration, what brought the public banking prospect forward for you, and how do you think that's fitting now?
Well, first let me say thank you for having me and allowing me to serve on the Institute's advisory board. So, you know, I came to politics from research. I did research in the connections between disaster and poverty and pre-existing conditions. And one of the things that I found was that there is this pervasive narrative that goes back to the 1780s, where when there is a disaster, wealthy and powerful people get made whole as part of the recovery. And working people are told, you know what, if we help you too much, there's a chance that we'll create dependence. And so this narrative of deserving and undeserving is something that I've traced across most major disasters over the last couple hundred years. And there's been a few blips, you know, the New Deal being one of them, although it wasn't fully inclusive, but it was an example of where we temporarily cast aside who should get what, you know, and challenge sort of the class and power structures of this country. And so the reason why I got involved in public banking was, you know, in my first 6 years in office, I got to lead most all social and economic justice issues in city council, whether it was raising the minimum wage, guaranteeing paid sick leave, combating wage theft, protecting vulnerable housing, and I'm proud of all that work. But as I started getting to the end of my second term, I started reflecting on this work, and I don't think we shifted the narrative of deserving and undeserving. We won basic dignities for working people, but we didn't move the needle in terms of, are they able to be more economically and socially mobile? Are they barely keeping their heads above water, or are they actually working and getting ahead? And the thing that I kept running into on every legislative effort was, Amaya, what about the markets? What about supply and demand and some of these things? And the thing that I kept coming back to is financialization has allowed banks and corporations to accumulate wealth and power to determine the rules of the market and then use that wealth and power to dictate what government does. And if government and the public only fights in one arena, it's a losing battle. And so for me, public banking was a crystallization of recognizing that the only way for the public to make the markets work for working people is for us to be a market participant.
That's a really beautiful description of the problem, which is a foundational kind of a paradigm shift of you have to work to earn your living as opposed to just being having some right of deserving right, a human right, to participate in an economy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see this current situation, the COVID crisis, as helping to clarify or to further confuse this orientation?
Yeah, so, you know, everyone talked about how wonderful the economy was. Well, not everyone, but a lot of leading economists and politicians, right? But what we knew is, despite historical lows in unemployment and sort of record gains in the market, what we knew is that only 4 in 10 Americans had $400 in the bank for an emergency. 1 in 3 people were living check to check, even those making $100,000 or more. 1 in 3 parents couldn't afford to buy diapers. And so now this COVID pandemic has made all of this one big soup. And now everyone, 25, 26% unemployment, all of this is coming to bear at once. And so there is an opportunity, I believe, to rewrite the rules of the economy. And I think public banks are foundational to that rewriting of the rules, because this is not about whether we get rid of markets or whether we have unfettered markets. The beauty of public banks is that it's a public option to Wall Street, that it's a competitor to, not a replacement for. And so, Ellen, I've read your writing, and some of what, you know, I try to cite from that is to say the public has more money in the market than any other actor when you factor in public pension money. So why not lever that, you know, in the way that private actors use their money as activists? Why can't the public be an activist through a public bank and finance the public good in the way that the Reconstruction Finance Corporation was an activist on behalf of the federal government?
Yeah, that's great. I totally agree. You know that, and I know you've written about universal basic income as well, which mm-hmm. are you researching that now and writing about it?
Yeah, so I'm doing a couple things, and these things connect. For the Economic Security Project, I'm working on guaranteed income efforts and cash transfers as part of the social safety net. And this goes back to the narrative of deserving and undeserving. So, you know, mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan talked about the welfare queen. Bill Clinton codified it by making sure that people, moms and dads, couldn't buy diapers and wipes with SNAP, which is the reason why diapers and wipes are locked up at drugstores, is because people are stealing them and they don't have access to them. So the point with universal basic income or a guaranteed income was to demonstrate the prejudice that's built into our social safety net and sort of begin the process of unwinding it and giving people dignity and access to cash to make decisions for themselves. And then the other bucket of work is public banking with the Open Society Foundations. And I'm blessed to have that support, George Soros' foundation. And I think they're interested in public banking and thinking about how we increase worker power, how we make sure that public finances are used to finance the public good.
That's great. Yeah, the pushback I always get on universal basic income is, first of all, it'll be inflationary, And second of all, that it's, like you say, that the worthy, unworthy thing that you'll make people mm-hmm. lazy. But then they never look at the fact that wealthy people are all living on a dividend, and they're not necessarily lazy. I mean, they all get, and I'm quite sure that poor people who would get a basic income are not going to go out and splurge and spend it on frivolous things because, like you say, they've got no savings. They're going to put that into savings. They need some savings. They need some cushion. So that money will just void out because money is created as a debt, and it's extinguished when the debts are paid off. So that would just go right into their bank account, zero out the debts, and it would not be inflationary.
No, and, you know, if we were worried about inflation, you know, we wouldn't be creating so much trillions of dollars in new cash and pumping it through the economy to backstop, you know, hedge funds and banks today, right?
Yeah, so they've clearly blown that argument.
Yeah. I mean, clearly we recognize that deflation is a bigger threat than inflation is, and we know that government spending is the best antidote to deflationary impacts, yet what the federal government is currently doing is saying, yes, we're going to make rich and wealthy people and banks whole and spend, but we're going to make working people beg for help. And, you know, to me, the frustrating part is we've given wealthy interests a blank check and the equivalent of a gift card to working people.
Yeah, and there aren't even strings attached. I mean, we're battling now that states are second-class citizens. So banks can borrow for free, 0.25% at the discount window, and even J.P. Morgan has admitted going there to borrow, which is it's someplace that they used to never go except because it was like a black mark on their records. And meanwhile, the states, if they go to this new municipal lending facility, which is a new municipal liquidity facility.
Yeah.
That they have to pay a penalty rate on top of the market rate. They're not getting 0.25%. So why are states considered more risky than local governments? It's because the banks, sorry, I think I said that wrong. Why are banks less risky than states? Because banks are underwritten by the federal government, totally now underwritten by the Federal Reserve. And the states should be as well. I mean, we've got a tax base. We've got all kinds of assets. So,
well, so some of this is right. That's a great point. Part of, you know, what I try to explain to people when we talk about public banks is, in my mind, the reason why states and cities will pay that sort of penalty rate is to protect the municipal bond market, which the banks generate billions in fees underwriting. They will argue that states and cities will be subject to moral hazard, right? That they'll just borrow irresponsibly. But on the other hand, say nothing about the electronic money that they're, you know, creating at the press of a button. And, you know, some people will always say, Maya, you know, that's just quantitative easing. It's not real money being injected. It's just to help them settle their trades. And my point is, at some point, that real money, that fake money, gets converted into real money, right? Whether it's through fees from the PPP loan processing or through the settlement of trades and overnight lending. These are things that we don't talk enough about. And again, this comes back to deserving and undeserving. You know, we've codified this idea that the banks know what they're doing, even though we bail them out every 10 years or so. And the public doesn't really understand economics.
Intentionally, they don't really want us to understand.
So in your role as a city councilman, which I imagine is a role you're probably still relieved to not have, I don't want to presume that on you, Amaya, but it's a lot of work to be a city councilman, and you had some really stellar leadership aspects there. But from the standpoint of a city council person in a city like Chicago, a prospect or an alternative like a public bank, where does it fit into how the city would control its finances? What kind of differences do you think a public bank would have made in Chicago or could make in Chicago?
You know, the city's $8 billion portfolio is actually quite big. You know, one of our major depositories is J.P. Morgan Chase. You know, we've essentially privatized the management of these dollars, right? And so there's no real say in how these dollars get used. And, I think the frustrating part to me about our portfolio is that, you know, Chase will say, well, we don't really make any money off the city. We're doing you a favor by holding these dollars, but they then use our dollars, create new money based using our dollars, and then in many ways lend it back to us and make money off of that. I just think that there's a better way to manage our dollars. It doesn't mean that we move away from any private depositories. It just means that by having a public competitor in the marketplace, you can align that competitor, meaning the public bank, with our agenda. Right. So I'll give you one quick example on affordable housing. The city's mandate was, if you received a zoning change where you're building 10 units or more, 10% of those units would have to be affordable, or you would pay $100,000 to the city in lieu of building that unit on site, right? So if you got a 20-unit zoning zoning change, two units would have to be built on site that were affordable, or you'd pay $200,000. At the local level, many aldermen would say, well, we want 25%, right? I represented a ward that was doing very well and had lots of mass transit, but also was losing affordable housing. And so when I would ask for 25% on site by upping the mandate, the banks and the developers would say, well, we can't, the deal doesn't pencil out anymore, right? Now, some of it is true, and some of it is the banks and developers being developers and banks. But the banks would say, look, the risk on this deal changes because you're basically adding additional rent control units to the deal, so it doesn't pencil out. Imagine if a public bank said, you know what? Yes, on a spreadsheet, the returns don't pencil out based on what JP Morgan is saying, but we as a city believe we should finance this deal because guess what? More affordable housing units means more working people, and over 25 years is how we measure returns because we need a bigger tax base and a more diverse tax base.
It might actually pencil out because as a public bank, you wouldn't be paying your shareholders or $20 million in CEO.
Yeah.
Salaries. Yeah.
Yeah. So part of it is that the work that I'm doing now is, one, trying to push for changes to the way we define fiduciary duty as a part of the public banking work, because, you know, government and pension funds are immortal. We don't have to chase the 7% return next quarter if that means busting unions or gutting jobs, that we might be able to get 8.5% over 30 years because our returns also mean additional population or a bigger tax base. And because the definitions are amorphous and they're really defined by Wall Street, this is yet another reason why public banks are important. I see public banks as a vehicle and an agenda.
So a number of years ago, you were you introduced the TIF accountability ordinance that attacks incremental financing. Could you speak to how that component of municipal finance is faring and how it fits into, say, having a public bank? If you had a public bank, what might otherwise happen with that sort of tax increment financing scheme?
Part of what we've done over the last 30, 40 years is relied on market-based tools and these tax incentive schemes to finance social problems or address social problems. And in many ways, they're inequitable because they're, I'll give you an example. The ward that I used to represent had a few tax increment finance districts, and I was able to finance all kinds of public projects using those dollars. Now, that was part of my job. But it also, at the same time, increased and perpetuated inequity, right? Because I represented a ward that was doing better from an economic standpoint, certainly not any more deserving than any other community, but simply because our tax base was performing better for a variety of reasons, including institutional racism that it, you know, perpetuates in the city over the last century or more, I was able to do more. But by helping my constituents, I was simultaneously increasing inequality, right? And that tension is hard to address without looking at it from a systemic perspective, because if I built a school addition in my community using tax increment finance, it was because we really had an overcrowding problem in our schools. So, but without a systemic perspective, me taking punitive action on my constituents doesn't make a whole lot of sense either. So that's the problem that these sort of half measures create. Instead, what we should do is think about, well, what is the citywide agenda? How do we make sure that we invest equitably, and in doing so, we don't, create winners and losers.
Yeah. You mentioned about the pension funds, too. That's another place where we always have tension between the pension funds want to make their money. People always say if we moved all the federal debt onto the books of the Fed, you would cut out the pension funds or you would cut out Social Security. How are they going to make their money? But it seems to me we just, and you know who's running all those things is BlackRock, which is investing in things that we the people would not invest in ourselves and would not approve of. We have no management over it. It seems to me we need a totally different security system instead of making our old age be dependent on investments that take advantage of others, and not everybody gets that same sort of advantage. We need something more equitable.
So you bring up a really great point. So part of my work is central, focuses on organized labor as part of public banking efforts, right? Because even if you look at Chicago, for example, the $8 billion portfolio is quite big. But imagine if labor decided to partner with the cities to launch state and city versions of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. So here's the thing that people often don't acknowledge, is that while so many people tell us that government is, you know, too broke and broken to do anything, the fact is that one third of the U.S. GDP is pension funds, the annual GDP, right? So, and Wall Street makes a killing off of public money, right? At the same time telling us why that pensions are not sustainable. Very clever and infuriating to me. So if labor decided that they wanted to reallocate those dollars instead of going to BlackRock or through alternative investment vehicles like hedge funds and private equity, and instead invest in infrastructure through public banking, well, they could simultaneously create new members by, with the project labor agreements and stabilize the fund over time, right? Because you're not only generating returns, you're creating new members. And that is how pension funds become more solvent over time. So what I want to do is, this is why fiduciary duty is so important, because both for cities and for states, it's a critical element in making sure public banks become a reality across the country, is forcing people to define, what do you mean by returns? Which time horizon? Whose time horizon? Who gets to decide what the time horizon is? Because that will, in my mind, help shape what the fiduciaries actually do. And I think, in my conversations with labor, they'll say the same thing. They'll say things like, we actually have worker representation on pension funds, right, as fiduciaries. And what, a recent conversation I had was with the local here in Chicago, and he's like, look, if I've got someone who is on, in the field, on a construction site all day, working 80 hours a week, and then they go and say, we need to have more project labor agreements, more infrastructure projects out in our pension funds. And the investment consultant says, you shouldn't be an activist here, because if you make a mistake, you're personally liable, or you could potentially even go to jail. That's how Taft-Hartley is interpreted. And when those kinds of conversations happen, of course, that union worker is going to defer to the Wall Street consultant, right, out of fear. And so some of this is about addressing the definitions of fiduciary duty in the context of public banking, because I believe we can partner with labor as the public, and the Green New Deal can be financed 3.5 times over just through pension funds without raising a penny in taxes.
Yeah,
boy,
that'd be great.
Yeah, Maya, you've raised so many valuable insights and points about it, especially at a time when everything is up in the air. What's going to be settling out, and what kind of systems and resources are we going to be left with when this crisis passes? It's wonderful to hear your articulation of how the public bank fits into this from a systemic standpoint. Your economic security project, could you tell us a little bit about what that is? And
sure. So the Economic Security Project was founded by Chris Hughes, Dorian Warren, and Natalie Foster. Dorian Warren is this incredible organizer, runs the Center for Community Change. Natalie Foster is an alum of the Obama administration and leads future of work efforts at the Aspen Institute and, you know, out in California. And then Chris Hughes was one of the founders of Facebook and then has now said, you know, maybe it's time to start breaking up Facebook. And they formed the Economic Security Project a few years ago to start thinking about cash, basic income, and cash transfers as an addition to, not a replacement for, the safety net. So they've been supporting the Stockton Seed Project, where Mayor Michael Tubbs has piloted $500 a month in unconditional cash. They've supported Aisha Yandoro in Jackson, Mississippi with the Magnolia Mothers Trust, where they provide $1,000 a month to 24 black moms living in public housing, unconditional cash, and kind of talking about the results of that. They supported my task force that I chaired in Chicago on basic income. And so they're trying to make cash a part of the broader conversation, and in fact have been leading efforts in D.C. and as part of the CARES negotiations to make sure that, you know, we're providing unconditional cash to working people, and we're helpful in getting the first $1,200 out to people, but, you know, continue to advocate for regular cash payments for as long as this crisis lasts, that the solutions should match the scale of the crisis. And they do, you know, what I appreciate about them and being a senior fellow with them is that, you know, they're not just about pushing the policy. They believe in narrative change, provoking stakeholders so that it's that you're challenging people's, you know, sort of foundational beliefs about who deserves. And I think through that, they are able to, I think, change hearts and minds. And to me, that's critical because I think that's what plagues America is this idea that we think some people deserve more than others. And, you know, this is how you get to, you know, at a very high level, how you get to a place where banks can access money for next to nothing, right? And at a very grassroots community level, we deny people the ability to buy diapers and wipes of public aid.
You mentioned that a third of annual GDP goes to the pension funds. I didn't realize that. How do you mean?
So if you pre-pandemic, the total value of U.S. pensions, including Taft-Hartley, so private sector pensions and public pensions, was between $7 and $10 trillion invested in the markets. So it's about a third of the U.S. annual GDP.
Wow.
Right.
Yeah.
So it doesn't go to it's worth about
a third.
I see what
you mean. It's
yeah.
Compared to so, right.
And so that, and you know, that doesn't even count the city portfolios, right? Or the state portfolios, or rainy day funds, or the value of muni markets. So my point is that, you know, we as the public, we make this market, right? Like it's our resources that are the fuel for these bonuses and fees and, you know, solid returns in many cases. But shouldn't we have a bigger say in how these dollars are invested and used and what they finance?
Right.
Well, as we like to say, it's our money.
Yeah.
On this program, we've always thought the pension funds were opportunities for public banks to not only get started, but to stimulate a much more productive approach to investment in local economies. And we want to find a way forward, or at least want to work together on a way forward on how we can start to institute that. It seems to me that, as you say, it's the status quo is preserved in part by fear and by notions that this is beyond, you know, your understanding, and this really, we've got to make our returns, which of course we don't always make. But now we're at a point where unsatisfied liabilities, it's a boogeyman, mm-hmm. it would seem. Pension liabilities are being looked at entirely wrong, or at least in a very disadvantageous way, and that now they have, that disadvantage seems to have been codified in the with the accounting rules that they're pushing through, or mm-hmm. that has changed, to put it on the, you know, the fixed liabilities of the state. Well, that's a very rich area for deeper conversation.
And I think we have to expand this movement so that it will normalize these issues and the concept of banking, but also I think embed labor in this, because I think I think far too often it's out of fear, right? We always measure the unfunded liability as this this deficit, this really, you know, this ball and chain that follows us around, when really, you know, Wall Street, on the other hand, looks at these annual contributions as like, well, wow, look at all the fees we're going to generate. Of course they want to invest it, right? So, like, you know, the cognitive dissonance here, and again, this is really about challenging the economic orthodoxy, right? Like, economists have been wrong about most things, right? So why do we, you know, defer to them on all of these issues? There is some common sense here that I think average people can also bring to the table to say this doesn't make sense, despite what your fancy math says.
Boy, that's beautifully said.
That was great, Amaya. You're very articulate. You say that well.
Thank you for what you all have done, right? I mean, I think you are the driver of why, you know, this is how change happens, right? For a while, people are talking about specific issues, and they're like, ah, that's too fringe, don't worry, but, you know. And now, this is part of the lexicon for recovery, right? The Washington Post had a column about public banks and the North Dakota Public Bank yesterday. You know, what you all have done is not only laid the foundation, but also made it possible for people like me who are in office to say, this is exactly what we should be doing. And so I appreciate the work. And, you know, I just think that there is an opportunity in this moment to go big and say that that is the only solution, that if we try to create a recovery based on austerity and going back to where we were a few months ago, that's just not going to cut it this time.
Right, for sure.
Is there a website that you'd like to direct our listeners to about the Economic Security Project or some other project that you think would be enlightening and inspiring to them?
Yeah, I mean, the economicsecurity.org is the place to find work information about guaranteed income and work that we're doing.
Well, Amaya, thank you once again for being on the program today, and we will be talking to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Amaya.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.